Such shiftings about of population became a very distinctive part of the political methods of the Assyrian new empire. Whole nations who were difficult to control in their native country would be shifted en masse to unaccustomed regions and amidst strange neighbors, where their only hope of survival would lie in obedience to the supreme power. Sargon's son, Sennacherib, led the Assyrian hosts to the borders of Egypt. There Sennacherib's army was smitten by a pestilence, a disaster described in the 19th chapter of the second book of Kings. And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed, and went, and returned, and dwelt at Nineveh. Sennacherib's grandson, Assurbanipal, called by the Greeks Sardanapalus, did succeed in conquering and for a time holding Lower Egypt. 2 E. The Assyrian Empire lasted only 150 years after Sargon II. Fresh nomadic Semites, coming from the southeast, the Chaldeans, assisted by two Aryan-speaking peoples from the north, the Medes and Persians, combined against it and took Nineveh in 606 BC. The Chaldean Empire, with its capital at Babylon, Second Babylonian Empire, lasted under Nebuchadnezzar the Great, Nebuchadnezzar II, and his successors, until 539 BC, when it collapsed before the attack of Cyrus, the founder of the Persian power. And so the story goes on. In 330 BC, as we shall tell later in some detail, a Greek conqueror, Alexander the Great, is looking on the murdered body of the last of the Persian rulers. The story of the Tigris and Euphrates civilizations, of which we've given as yet only the bare outline, is a story of conquest following after conquest, and each conquest replaces old rulers and ruling classes by new. Races like the Sumerian and the Elamite are swallowed up, their languages vanish, they interbreed and are lost. The Assyrian melts away into Chaldean and Syrian. The Hittites become Aryanized and lose distinction. The Semites who swallowed up the Sumerians give place to Aryan rulers. Medes and Persians appear in the place of the Elamites. The Aryan-Persian language dominates the empire until the Aryan Greek ousts it from official life. Meanwhile, the plow does its work year by year. The harvests are gathered, the builders build as they're told, the tradesmen work and acquire fresh devices. The knowledge of writing spreads, novel things, the horse and wheeled vehicles and iron, are introduced and become part of the permanent inheritance of mankind. The volume of trade upon sea and desert increases, men's ideas widen, and knowledge grows. There are setbacks, massacres, pestilence, but the story is, on the whole, one of enlargement. For 4,000 years, this new thing, civilization, which had set its foot into the soil of the two rivers, grew as a tree grows, now losing a limb, now stripped by a storm, but always growing and resuming its growth. After 4,000 years, the warriors and conquerors were still going to and fro over this growing thing they didn't understand. But men had now, 330 BC, got iron, horses, writing and computation, money, a greater variety of foods and textiles, a wider knowledge of their world. The time that elapsed between the empire of Sargon I and the conquest of Babylon by Alexander the Great was as long, be it noted, at the least estimate, as the time from Alexander the Great to the present day. And before the time of Sargon, men had been settled in the Sumerian land, living in towns, worshipping in temples, following an orderly Neolithic agricultural life in an organized community for at least as long again. Eridu, Lagash, Ur, Uruk, Larsa, have already an immemorial past when first they appear in history. One of the most difficult things for both the writer and student of history is to sustain the sense of these time intervals and prevent these ages becoming shortened by perspective in his imagination. Half the duration of human civilization and the keys to all its chief institutions are to be found before Sargon I. Moreover, the reader can't too often compare the scale of the dates in these latter fuller pages of man's history with a succession of countless generations to which the time diagrams which we've given bear witness. Third, parallel with the ancient beginnings of civilization in Sumeria, a parallel process was going on in Egypt. It's still a matter of discussion which was the most ancient of these two beginnings, or how far they had a common origin or derived one from the other. The story of the Nile Valley, from the dawn of its traceable history until the time of Alexander the Great, isn't very dissimilar from that of Babylonia. But while Babylonia lay open on every side to invasion, Egypt was protected by desert to the west, and by desert and sea to the east, while to the south she had only Negro peoples. Consequently, her history is less broken by the invasions of strange races than is the history of Assyria and Babylon, and until towards the 8th century BC, when she fell under an Ethiopian dynasty, whenever a conqueror did come into her story, he came in from Asia, by way of the Isthmus of Suez. The Stone Age remains in Egypt are of very uncertain date. There are Paleolithic and then Neolithic remains. It's not certain whether the Neolithic pastoral people who left those remains were the direct ancestors of the later Egyptians. In many respects, they differed entirely from their successors. They buried their dead, but before they buried them, they cut up the bodies and apparently ate portions of the flesh. They seem to have done this out of a feeling of reverence for the departed. The dead were eaten with honor, according to the phrase of Mr. Flinders Petrie. It may have been that the survivors hoped to retain thereby some vestige of the strength and virtue that had died. Traces of similar savage customs have been found in the long barrows that were scattered over Western Europe before the spreading of the Aryan peoples, and they have pervaded Negro Africa, where they're only dying out at the present time. About 5,000 BC or earlier, the traces of these primitive peoples cease, and the true Egyptians appear on the scene. The former people were hut builders, and at a comparatively low stage of Neolithic culture. The latter were already a civilized Neolithic people. They used brick and wood buildings instead of their predecessors' hovels, and they were working stone. Very soon they passed into the Bronze Age. They possessed a system of picture writing, almost as developed as the contemporary writing of the Sumerians, but quite different in character. Possibly there was an eruption from southern Arabia by way of Aden, of a fresh people who came into Upper Egypt and descended slowly towards the delta of the Nile. Dr. Wallace Budge writes of them as conquerors from the east. But their gods and their ways, like their picture writing, were very different indeed from the Sumerian. One of the earliest known figures of a deity is that of a hippopotamus goddess, and so very distinctively African. The clay of the Nile isn't so fine and plastic as the Sumerian clay, and the Egyptians made no use of it for writing, but they early resorted to strips of the papyrus reed fastened together, and from whose name comes our word paper. The broad outline of the history of Egypt is simpler than the history of Mesopotamia. It has long been the custom to divide the rulers of Egypt into a succession of dynasties, and in speaking of the periods of Egyptian history, it's usual to speak of the first, fourth, 14th, and so on, dynasty. The Egyptians were ultimately conquered by the Persians after their establishment in Babylon, and when finally Egypt fell to Alexander the Great in 332 BC, it was dynasty 31 that came to an end. In that long history of over 4,000 years, a much longer period than that between the career of Alexander the Great and the present day, certain broad phases of development may be noted here. There was a phase known as the Old Kingdom, which culminated in the Fourth Dynasty.